This podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha. This Dharma talk was given by Roshi Amy Hollowell.
Hello again. Hello for those who were not here earlier. Hello, good morning, good afternoon. So the group is still less extensive than it probably will be during the weekend because it's a holiday in France and it's not anywhere else. So I'm assuming people are working today. They're practicing with us anyway, whatever they're doing. This morning, in my email box, there was a newsletter from the Zen Center of Los Angeles, in which it's a weekly newsletter, and they say what their programs are for the week. And it's in one of their programs, because it's the anniversary of Maizumi Roshi's death in 1995. I'm not sure which day it is exactly, but they're doing a ceremony tomorrow. In any case, there was a quote from Maizumi Roshi, something about as soon as you have a, he said something to the effect of, don't set yourself a goal or an objective, because as soon as you do that, you will become involved with grasping the three poisons, right? Greed, anger, and ignorance. And you will miss what the true objective is, like I said yesterday, to be, to stay with your present experience of things as they are right here now. If you're looking somewhere else, you won't be present to this experience. I don't remember exactly how he said this, and I'm not going to go look for it now, but that got me to thinking, remembering what last night, Debbie said something about wanting to transgress and go off and smoke a cigarette or do something else. And she wanted to do something that was outside of the sesshin. And I said, well, nothing is outside of the sesshin. So there's nothing to transgress. There's nowhere to go. And that fits with what Maizumi Roshi was saying. Or with this koan that we have, the one who shoots the arrow well does not hit the target. And what does that mean? If you shoot the arrow well, you don't hit the target. We usually think the opposite. That if you really shoot that arrow well and you aim and you know how to hold the bow and hold the arrow and how to do it, if you master that technique, you will hit the target. However, if you're aiming for the target, you'll miss the target. Because not aiming for the target is the target, something like that. Or as Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, nothing holy. As soon as you set up a target of something that's holy, or sacred, I think is what we should say. As soon as you set up that something that is sacred, then there's something that's not sacred. And you miss the sacredness of all things. The absolute perfection of all things. You miss the target, which is this, right here now, this is the target. And I recently read something about the difference between Chinese and Japanese in terms of Chan and Zen Buddhism, which have the same root, but also just in general, the way that the practices manifested in the two cultures and how that then relates to our practice. And apparently, the word freedom or liberation, we call this a path of liberation, right? We say that our practice is one of becoming free. We chant, vast is the robe of liberation. And that we share with the it's both in Chinese and in Japanese Zen. Certainly comes from originally the original Buddhist teachings as well. But apparently the ideograms for the word freedom in Chinese and the word freedom in Japanese are slightly different. And the Chinese ideogram translates as to be free from, freedom from. Whereas the Japanese ideogram translates as freedom within, freedom in the midst of. And that speaks directly to what our practice is, especially this practice that we're doing here. When we say we're together at home, this is a retreat together at home. We're not looking to be free from all of this, from our daily lives, from anything. We're looking to be free within it, here and now, in the heart of our life. We used to call these retreats retreat in the heart of life, because that's what we're looking for, is freedom here, in the midst. And this is a very slight shift. The way that Chinese practiced it, this is what we call Zen, was often, you know, the images of the wandering monk, the wandering hermit, the guy living off in a hut, the crazy wise man. Not so much, and even the monastic practice was not so ritualized as it became later in Japan. Whereas in Japan, it became very, and this has to do with the culture and the whole, the aesthetic as well, became very precise, ritualized disciplines that were intended to help us, or help the practitioner, let go of the attachment to self and see the origin of this self, and therefore to be free wherever. You didn't have to go off and live in a mountain to be free. You didn't have to be free from the social constructs and the obligations of daily life. The whole point of the Japanese version was to free us here, in, to be free within. And that's what we discover in our disciplines that we do, in our rituals. There's great freedom within the structure that we have. You have certain, we say we will sit for 30 minutes, but within that 30 minutes, anything is possible. Anything. And everything does arise in those 30 minutes. And if we look at the rituals and the forms and strict Japanese discipline that we've inherited as something that we, as a target that we need to arrive at and master, then we miss again what the point is. Of course, it's very important to, as I said last night, repeatedly do one thing well. Repeatedly chant, repeatedly walk a certain way, repeatedly do Orioki, which unfortunately we haven't been able to do for a year and a half, but repeatedly bow. And then we become free. When we lose our attachment to me bowing, because that's what the freedom is. The freedom is letting go of this fixed idea of self, this idea of self, in whatever circumstance, wherever you are. I remember a story of a samurai, some story somewhere, where there's this samurai who has this very ritualistic practice, which is also a practice, a deep spiritual practice of letting go of self as well, and has to pursue a criminal of some kind, and pursues him, and finally catches up with him, and he's supposed to kill the guy. And he's cornered him, and the criminal's back is to the wall, and the samurai draws his sword, and the criminal spits on him, insults him and spits on him. And the samurai replaces his sword and walks away. And when he returned to his, you know, whoever his master was, and his master asked about it, he told him the story, and the master said, "Why didn't you kill him?" And he said, "Because if I had, when he spit on me, I became angry. And if I had killed him, I would have been acting on my anger. And it would have been about me. It would no longer have been about this being one with the situation and what was appropriate." Now, this is probably some kind of mythical story, but it speaks to this notion of being one with the situation, not being fixed on the target. Because if you're separate, if there's you, the arrow, the target, then you're separate. And doing it truly well, this of course it's not judgment in the case of not well or well, but to do it with full wisdom and compassion, let's say, there is no target. Because there's no separation between you and target and arrow. But of course, this can't, I'm saying all of this, I'm using words to say this, but it can only be experienced. And that too is the beauty of our practice. That there is no, unlike the Indian practices, where originally, after the Buddha, the Buddhism took root, where there were sutras and visualizations and gurus and ritualistic. You had to climb up the ladder to, and you had numerous lives, innumerable lives. As it evolved to us today, this is the life. This is the moment of awakening. Where you're sitting is the throne of awakening. Your life is the pure land, as some of the traditions say. There's nowhere to go but here. There's something I thought. Oh yes, when I said innumerable. In that same text where I saw the thing about the notion, the ideogram for freedom, apparently, the word for many, which in Japanese, in our Zen tradition, we translate as the 10,000 things. In Chinese, it's translated more often as myriad or innumerable. Now, sometimes in our chants, we use both. We don't say there are 10,000 sentient beings. We say 10,000 beings are numberless. But we do, from Dogen, we have inherited this use of the word 10,000, this phrase 10,000 things. Because 10,000 things applies to, it's a number, it's concrete, although it means limited, limitless. Whereas when we say innumerable, it's kind of vague. It's just, it's like so many. But 10,000 things, 10,000, we're putting a word on it. We're making it concrete, even though it still means the same thing. But words are important. The way that we translate a word is very important. And we have inherited this, our practice is comes from both of those, from Chinese and Japanese, but we're closer to and have inherited more directly the 10,000 things than the myriad things. Although it means the same thing. And it's like, so there's a pause, and pauses are important. Instead of just this flow of words, it's important to hear the silence, to hear the pause, to see what arises. Because that's when I stop like that, that's what I'm doing. I'm just looking to see what arises, in order to stay as close as possible to this moment, to come back to this moment, to come back to just what is here right now. What is the, to come back to the mysterious, I don't know. That's, we also get that from Bodhidharma. When he's asked by the emperor, who is he? Who is standing here before me? Who is telling me that there is nothing sacred? Who is this? Who is transgressing like this? Who is, you know, who is daring to speak this blasphemy that there is nothing sacred and that all of these great things I have done, all of the effort I've put into preserving and protecting temples and financing statues and all of these, the way I've, all of this materials wealth I have that I've used to support the teachings. And you're telling me that nothing is sacred. Who is telling me this? And Bodhidharma, I don't know. He doesn't even know. I would say in our language, I don't even know. Because as soon as he says, this is who I am, he's shooting at the target. Whereas the target is, I don't know. It's the great mystery. It's the meaning of all of this is the mystery. Not mystery in a sense of, this great anxiety of, I really want to know the outcome. I want to know what happens in the fourth season of the series. Even having a position of, I really want Israel and the Palestinians to come to a peace accord and have a two-state solution. As soon as we're fixed on that target, there will be disappointment, frustration, anger, greed, because we'll be grasping for that solution. It's a terrible, terrible thing that's happening. It has been happening all of these forever, it seems. Decades and decades and decades and centuries and centuries and centuries in what we call the Holy Land. And part of the problem is because we call it the Holy Land. Everybody calls it the Holy Land, and that's part of the problem. Not because it's not a holy land, but it's that we don't see that every land is holy. And everyone has the same holy land. One of the astronauts, one of the original astronauts, Americans, who was in space and was one of the first ones, I think, to walk outside of the capsule, to do a spacewalk, as we say. And there was some kind of, he was waiting to go, and there was some kind of technical issue they were trying to resolve, or it was a little delayed. So he had 5 minutes where he was alone in this part of the ship, waiting for his moment to go out. And he saw, we can't even say below him, but he saw Earth and was deeply moved. You know, we have these great, we've heard these stories of astronauts having moments of sublime awakening in that situation. And he told later, he said later, his first thought was, what have I done to deserve this? To have this precious opportunity to see this? And then his second thought was, please, let's take care of it. He saw the preciousness of that earth and the vulnerability of it, sitting there in the middle of nothing. And this is the Holy Land. I mean, it doesn't mean space, the moon, the sun, the other planets aren't holy, but this happens to be the Holy Land that is our home. And so to, you know, dispute a corner of it as being my Holy Land and not yours is to really miss, is to really be shooting for the target and missing shooting the arrow well. I have visited Jerusalem. I was fortunate to have visited it before the second Intifada, I think. It was in 2000, and so I think it was before. So it was peaceful, relatively peaceful. And so we basically could go anywhere. Of course, we had guides. I was in a Zen interfaith activity, but and so I went from the Damascus Gate to the Jaffa Gate. I went to the Lion's Gate in the Old City, and I didn't really realize, except that you could see when you went from West Jerusalem to East Jerusalem, that East Jerusalem was not nearly as well kept up as West. There was trash, the buildings were kind of not in good shape, not renovated. Well, East Jerusalem is where the Palestinians used to be Palestinian, now it's becoming encroached upon, and the money from the government was not going to East Jerusalem, it was going to West Jerusalem, to the Jewish parts of the city. In any case, apart from that, you couldn't really tell. Everybody looked the same, unless, you know, unless there was a Jew who had his particular headdress or an Arab who had his particular headdress. The people looked the same. And they were basically eating the same food. You could eat falafel at the Damascus Gate or at the Jaffa Gate. And it was as good in both places. And the distance was not very much. You know, I was telling my husband the other day about it, and he said, oh, it's so like between between the Damascus Gate, which is the east side, and the Jaffa Gate, which is the west side, it's like going from here to Quatrechevaux. So I live at a metro stop, Mairie de Montreuil, and I go do my grocery shopping at the Monoprix, which is at the next metro stop. I go there all the time. I walk, it's no problem. And the distance between those two gates is about like that in the walled old city. And the great mosque, the beautiful domed golden mosque that you see, is right below its wall, down below it, is the Wailing Wall. So there's really no, everything is so close. And then right outside of the Wailing Wall, a little bit away, you have the great church of the Saint, I forget what it's called, but the great Christian church, Greek Orthodox Church. They're all right there. And they're fighting about this, about whose it is and who is it more sacred for. The mosque is supposedly the fourth most holy place in Islam, but the temple is the most sacred place for the Jews. Well, you know, as soon as we start making these categories and saying it's more sacred for me than it is for you, we see the problems, right? This is not to shoot the arrow well. I'm not proposing any solutions. But I am seeing in it a great teaching. And I have seen in it forever, since I can remember. Like I said last night, look around. The teaching is everywhere. Everything is teaching. You can see in all beauty in all things. You can have anybody can become a yogi, right? Anybody can become a great meditator. Aiming for that target, become a great yogi. But challenge, can you, in this life, right here as it is, can you manifest it? Can you be that the great artist of your life? Can you embody the divine in yourself, which is the same divine is in all of us, but it manifests in different ways for each of us? Someone talking about artists said, no, a great artist is not a special man, but every man is a special artist. This is a very special artist in their own life. So you are the very special artist of your life. It was man, but let's say woman, person. And you can discover that when you're not trying to be the great artist of your life. Or when you are trying to be the great artist of your life by not trying to be the great artist of your life, or something like that. I really like that koan of not shooting the arrow straight. And of not shooting the arrow well. The other koan is, how do you go straight on a mountain path that has 99 curves? Which comes back to a similar teaching. And we also give this example of what has transpired in the past year and a half, or not year and a half, a little over a year with this whole pandemic situation, and how we have, we had to give up our straight path that we thought we were on and follow the curves, give up the target of going to Quimbra, the target of going to Fontainebleau, where we should have been this weekend, the target of being well or sick or whatever it was. I had to give up the target of being well. The target of living our lives as we wanted them to be. And follow the curves. And it's been such a fabulous experience, such a beautiful, beautiful experience. Even, you know, I, as we said with the puzzle, we just went one piece at a time. And we didn't know what, we still don't know what the whole puzzle is. But we do, because we are it. We know this. We are it right now. But every day it's another piece. At one point when I was, you know, going on and on with my long COVID, I went from specialist to specialist. And many of you have heard these stories of people or read these stories of people like me who, you know, have all these symptoms and they go to specialists and the specialists say, there's nothing wrong with you. So I did all the tests, you know, my heart's fine, my lungs are fine, my veins and arteries are fine. My eyes are fine, everything's perfect. All the blood work is fine, great, you know, and I was relieved every time, of course. You know, I've lost count of all the specialists I saw. And then ultimately I found a health worker who, you know, a specialist in holistic approach. I knew as I was getting the opinions from the specialists what I was doing. I knew that they could only tell me as far as their speciality. And I wanted that. I wanted to be able to say, discount this. Okay, there's no heart problem. There's no lung problem. I could, you know, move those things out of the way. And I knew that eventually I was looking for a holistic solution. But I didn't know, I needed to know the various aspects first. I needed to have all the pieces of the puzzle before I could find the holistic solution. And this was a great teaching too. You know, it was a fabulous experience to go through all of that. I don't wish it on anyone, and it was not fun. It was a lot of suffering, but at the same time, I learned it was such a great teaching. And such a great teaching to, I knew intuitively that it was missing the target to think that the cardiologist was going to cure me. Unless, of course, I had something wrong with my heart. And then I would, of course, rely on the cardiologist. Or even, you know, the advice from the lung doctor who said, well, there's nothing wrong with your lungs, but we've discovered that people's lungs have memories and they remember the trauma that they experienced. And so what we suggest is, you know, you go to a physiotherapist and you retrain your lungs. Makes total sense. He didn't say, take this medicine. He didn't say, there's nothing wrong with your lungs. I can't do anything for you. makes total sense, right? And I knew intuitively when something sounded right, when the target was not being hit in the way that we usually think of it. And I could know that intuitively because of my practice, because I sit every moment with not aiming for the target. And now I know I can already hear the way that our thoughts are going. Well, if we don't have a goal, what are we doing? So I shouldn't say, shouldn't even sit. I shouldn't, in French we would say, à quoi bon? Well, what's the use? I can do anything then. It's not it either, because that's another target. Having no target is having a target. So this is really, this implies really staying just with what is and responding to what is. And of course, what is not what we think it is. The great story behind the name that my teacher gave me, my teacher gave me this name, Tu es cela, which means you are that. And this name comes from, I just came upon this today, I forgot completely about it, although I know it. It comes from the Upanishad, I don't know how you pronounce it, the Shandoga Upanishad. And the story, I'll just read it to you because this applies. So there's a father and a son. And the son is asking this father, what's the great teaching of life, or what is the meaning of life, or something like that. And the father says, bring me a fruit from that banyan tree. The son goes and gets it, and he said, here it is, venerable sir. Father says, break it. The son opens it up, the fruit, and he said, it's broken open, venerable sir. The father says, what do you see there? The son says, these seeds, they're very small. And the father says, break one of those seeds, my son. The son does it. It's broken, venerable sir. What do you see there? Nothing at all, venerable sir. The father said, that subtle essence, my son, which you do not perceive there, from that very essence, that great banyan tree arises. Believe me, my dear. Now, that which is the subtle essence in all that exists has itself. That is the true. That is the self. That is the true self. You are that, my son. So that's where this name comes from. But that's what all of our teachings come from. You are that. And in order to see that, we have to break down all the rest of it. Of course, our practice does not involve, some Tibetan practices are very, very elaborate, a very elaborate process of breaking things down to come to this, you are that, to come to what we call emptiness, what we call Buddha nature, what we call the true self, all of these things we say. In Zen, we don't have that. We don't have that elaborate process. It's what we say, the direct route, which is if you shoot the arrow well, you will not hit the target. Meaning, don't be attached to any, I am that, I am this. if we see the banyan tree as this, you know, isolated, disconnected thing, and we don't see that we are also that tree, that we have the same nature, we come from the same mystery, whatever you want to call it, that same divine aspect of being, then we will not take good care of the tree. Like the astronaut said, let's take good care of it. We will not take good care of ourselves and others either. And that story about you are that, my son, it's not a Buddhist story. It predates the Buddha's time. It's, you know, the Upanishads are, I forget what century, but, you know, this is very ancient, ancient, ancient teachings. But what it means is look into the nature of things. Instead of seeing some straight road, look into this moment and see what is, and be here with what is. And then there will be another moment, and there will be a curve, and there's something else. And then another moment, and there's another curve, and it's something else. And if we come from a place of I am that, or not knowing, you are that. It's not I am that, it's you are that. My teacher was very clever giving me the name, you are that. Then we can fully embody whatever is in this moment. We can flow. You know, we sometimes say be in the flow. Just means to be one with, to just be this. So I guess I will stop there and open it up for questions or comments for a few minutes so that we can finish on time.
Well, I'll start. Well, hello, everyone. Yeah, thank you for bringing up this story about Israel. And while you were talking, I started to envision this the Lament War, and I thought how ironic and how it can be a metaphor of us. Lamenting in front of a wall and just literally banging our heads. This is what we do. And we can lament ourselves about something and on a wall and just go on and keep going. So that's the image that I had when you were mentioning this. And that metaphor of also of wanting a very specific place to be the holy place and not seeing that it can really just be anywhere. And how it's like a koan, how Where's that wall? What is that wall? What is that wall that I bang my head on? How real is that wall? That's what came up for me.
Yes, and speaking of the wall, we also have this notion of the wall in our tradition of, you know, Bodhidharma facing the wall. I had never thought of that before, but as you mentioned, I mean, I've thought of Bodhidharma facing the wall, but I hadn't thought of it in terms of the what we call the wailing wall in English. In French, the mur de lamentation. And maybe there's something in that, that in Zen, we sit facing the wall. We don't lament something. We don't bang our heads against it. And facing the wall, the way that we have kind of started interpreting it through Dana, my teacher, and now us, is the wall, facing the wall of this very moment. We can physically turn around and face a wall while we sit, and that's very powerful to do that. And I have had you done that sometimes in retreats, but this facing the wall of the moment is also very powerful. And we can sometimes bang our heads against it. It's true. And we often do, or bump our heads on it. Like Jacques Lacan said, you know, reality is what we bump into. And so we do sometimes bump into that wall. But our practice is to sit facing it, like Bodhidharma, not turn away from it. Become the wall. Debbie, yeah?
Well, thank you very much, Roshi. The synchronicity is very strong, because the question yesterday was, how did you get involved in your practice? Or what was the first step? And I lived in Palestine, Jordan, whatever, now it's all mixed up. We used to go to Jerusalem for lunch. When I was just beginning, I was 12, 13, 14, so I was just beginning to get into a spiritual trip. And everybody on the street looked like Jesus, so it was easy. I wanted to be a Christian, because they were all walking around looking exactly what Jesus was supposed to look like. And these were the 60s, so there was peace was reigning between. That was the wonderful part. I've been talking about this with my Muslim friends during Ramadan. Since there were Christians, the ones that we know, then there were all the varieties of Orthodox, and the Jews and the Muslims. It was a party every day of the year, just about. Nobody took their Christmas tree lights down. It was all, and it was special food for all of these things. My neighbor's been sending me the most amazing food during Ramadan. I'm really sorry Ramadan is over, but in Jerusalem, it was Ramadan every day, because the Greeks had these wonderful things for the Epiphany. These, I don't know if you've, I've seen some in France, bread with an egg in the middle, a boiled egg, the bread. And everybody wishing everybody everything. And a great, there were not many Jews, but there were all kinds of Christians and all kinds of Muslims and free thinkers. And everybody was getting this before the Yom Kippur. So we were getting along more or less. And I have been back to Israel since then. East Jerusalem was not a trash bag, because it wasn't East and West Jerusalem. I don't want to get bogged down with the history of the Middle East, but everything was much less unbalanced in any case. And what was my point? I don't have a point, except that the other thing that you were saying that went around my head is the business that everybody that's in Jerusalem thinks it's the holy place. And this can be very strong. I mean, it's a very spiritual experience to walk through the holy places of your religion, but it's also a collective mentality that is too strong, because you can't chew gum. One day I sat near Al-Aqsa, this mosque we're talking about, and started doing yoga movements, an old Arab man came up and he started beating me with a cane. That is, hold on, you can't do that here. So everybody's protecting the territory of their rituals. And it's a conundrum. I mean, it's hard to make everybody happy. You can't. You have to kind of get in a line. I mean, we weren't affiliated with any religion. But if you want to do it now, you have to just be about, you have to be affiliated with something, because everybody's, my African friend got sermonized at the Wailing Wall because her sleeve was down to here and not down to here. Mainly just because she was black. I don't want to get started, I'll get mad. I'll either start crying or I'll get mad. When I think of the way Jerusalem was in the 60s and the way it is now, it's not just a weeping wall, it's a weeping shame. And I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but I have one other thing came up to me today while you were talking about this, getting your arrow right. One time in Katsong, I think it was during Frank's transmission, I was in a bedroom, in one of the rooms with my bedroom partner, and a bee came in, and we started kind of getting, ooh, a bee, and all of a sudden, I knew exactly what to do. It was one of those moments when we'd been meditating for 4 days. I grabbed the plastic bag that my sandwich was in, put the bee in there, threw the bag out the window, and it came out, the other girl was even more shook up than me because I kind of liked it, but she didn't. It was one of those moments when you do the right thing without thinking about it. That was my target arrow moment.
Yeah, thank you. Yep. Yep, absolutely, all of it. From the, you know, wanting things to be more holier than thou, and if you had been looking at, I would be really this great holy woman if I do this to the bee, it wouldn't have happened like that, probably. And, you know, that's a good example of just everyday experience. It's every moment. There's an opportunity. Every moment is an opportunity. Every moment is a gate. You know, the Dharma gates, we say. Every moment is. That's the beauty of these retreats we do, because we're in our own homes, in our daily lives, and we don't need anything special. We don't need a special altar. We don't need a special room. We don't need a special piece of clothing. Of course, some of us are wearing rakusus, but that's not what makes this what it is. That helps us to remember it, but it doesn't make it what it is. And I said my Dharma name, but all of your Dharma names are also the same. They're all saying the same thing. They're all saying the same thing.
It's like we're in outer space or something. I think it's probably because there's two, you know, things.
Me too soon.
There you go.
Oh, sorry. Just I would say just a very short comment about being with you since yesterday evening. It's really very precious and very moving also to hear you, Emmy Roshi. Thank you for this freshness again, well, let's say, to listen to your teaching. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dominique, for being with us. Ida too. Yeah. Ida and Dominique are my Dharma sisters. From we had the same teacher, Hanover. Mm.
Yeah.
Known each other a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
So it's wonderful to see you. So we are almost out of time. I guess on that note, we will end. That's a very nice note. Very happy. And we'll see you this afternoon later, at the end of the day, those of you who can return. And then tomorrow and Sunday as well, if you're able to. I hope so. So thank you. The talk has been recorded and will be online probably tomorrow. I think Lisa will post it, so you can hear it, or tell others who were not here if they want to hear it. Thank you.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.